Hello, everybody.
Hi.
And welcome to the Ballard Show.
That's not what this is.
Yes,
it is. I wasn't told that.
It is now. We're changing the graphics.
You're being told right now. So I think that's plenty of notice.
Congratulations. Welcome to your podcast.
It's all yours now. To be honest. So it's all right.
No, this is Saints and Witches. I'm Sarah. I'm a Catholic.
I'm Liz. I'm a witch.
And this is our good friend, David Ballard, who is...
I'm an unbeliever. So we have a nice triangle.
Who is a heathen. Yep. Ballard, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is David Ballard. I am currently an MFA student of creative writing, Southern Illinois University. I'm in my extra year at the moment. I lost some productivity in quarantine. It happens.
We all did.
My background is in classical history, particularly Roman history. So my thesis novel is set during the reign of the Emperor Nero. And that's what some of the stories we'll be talking about today. That's where they come from as well.
Nice. I am freaking pumped to talk about Nero and all things early Roman history. It's very sexy.
I may be biased, but Nero in particular and the whole Julio-Claudian dynasty is peak Roman history. That is as good as it gets, in my opinion.
I just like learning things from Ballard. Ballard, who randomly brings me like a book of like dicks in it. And it's like, here's
a book of dicks.
Yeah. You're welcome. The book of dicks. I'll never forget that. But Ballard makes learning so much fun. So I am excited.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And so when we were in like workshops together, Ballard would bring his like pieces of his thesis to workshop. And I remember thinking one of the times when we were reading one of his stories for workshop, like, oh my gosh, like this is actually what it might have felt like to be like an ancient Roman living in the city of Rome and just being like blown away.
I love how non-romanticized it is. Yeah. I mean that like positively, because everything else is just like, you know, it's so pristine. Let's not get our dirty fingers all over it. And Ballard's like, they pee in the streets.
They fuck in the streets. They shit in the streets.
There are other authors who do good work that focus on the lower classes. Most programs that'll go into classical history, they read their Cicero, they read their Tacitus, they read their Julius Caesar. They focus on the great works of literature that we have. Our program is a lot more focused on social history and like pieces of art and artifacts that illuminate sort of facts about real daily life. So that's sort of the background I come from, and that's what I try to work with.
I love that. And we're kind of about that too on the podcast. We're kind of about getting to the root of what experiences were actually like, instead of, you know, what the great literature tries to tell us they were. So yeah, this will be fun. Should we jump in?
Yeah,
sure.
Let's do it.
I could not figure out what to talk about at all up until yesterday. Like, I put it off, and then I looked some stuff up, but none of it really sounded like anything I wanted to talk about. So I figured it out yesterday. So this brief story is the product of about 6 hours of effort and absolutely no more.
Love that journey for you.
I am going to talk about the Strix, which I mentioned back in episode 11, I think, when I talked about Barbara Zudunk. But I said that I wasn't going to get into like the whole mess. We were talking about vampires and stuff, and I was like, yeah, that's a whole etymological thing that I'll deal with another day.
And I pretended to know what it was.
Yes.
I was like, yeah, the Strix, got it.
Yeah, anytime anything Catholic comes out of your mouth, I do the same thing. I'm like, yes, that thing. But they totally do.
Right.
Every time you say Western schism, I completely forget what it is. Until you describe it again.
Sometimes I forget too. Like, I forget which one is the great one and which one is the other one, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like a schism. How is that again? It sounds important.
I don't think we have time to get into which is which today. I don't think there's time. So maybe another time we'll talk about it.
Maybe another time. Anywho, the Strix is an ancient Roman/Greek mythological creature. The earliest Greek written record of it comes from, I am not going to say this correctly at all. I looked on the internet. There's nothing. So I'm just going to spell it for you, actually. Boios is the author.
Boios?
Yeah.
Call him Boios.
Our boy Boios.
Our boy Boios.
Yeah. In his Ornithologia, circa 4th century BC, which is a lost manuscript, but it's partially preserved in the Metamorphoses of this Ovid. Other guy that I can't say the other name of. It's not Ovid's. It's Liberalis's. I don't know how to say his first name.
How many Metamorphoses are there?
There's a lot.
So many.
There's a lot.
Five titles that people always want to use over and over.
I had no idea. I thought there was only one.
I clicked on it and I'm like, surely it's going to tell me how to say this guy's name. And then it just lists like everybody is an author but him. I'm like, I'm never going to find this.
Yeah.
So him, circa 2nd century AD. The Strix myth in essence is this story of a woman and her half-bear sons. Whose punishment for her sons being cannibals is them all being turned into animals.
Okay.
Like various birds. It's not dissimilar to Lycon's myth, with the whole cannibals being turned into animals thing, which is neat because of its connections to lycanthropy, and how the Strix, which is this, which the woman, the mother is turned into, is connected to witches and vampires. So.
Hmm.
The Strix is described by the story as a creature that, quote, cries by night without food or drink, with a head below and tips of feet above, a harbinger of war and civil strife to men, end quote. And you can probably see in that description how the Strix ends up connected to both the owl and the bat. So like this screaming bird, but also the description of its head being below its feet.
Hanging it's, upside down.
Yeah, it's a toss-up between the two.
Did you ever read that children's book, Stella Luna?
Mm-mm.
It's absolutely heartbreaking, but so, so good. Anyway, it reminded me of that because she's an orphaned bat. And so a group of birds, a family of birds takes her in, but the little baby birds make fun of her because she sleeps upside down. Yeah. Anyway. Not relevant.
Sad. Anyway. Owl and bat, but Strix is commonly translated as owl when you read the myths. So when I was running into it in other places, it wasn't saying like Strix, it was saying like the owl did this and owl did this.
Okay.
The first mention of the Strix in Latin comes from 191 BC in the comedy Pseudolus of Plautus. It took me a second to find the translation of what this mention was, because the academic article I was reading initially for it just kept quoting shit in Latin and Greek like we were all on the same page and we could all read
it. They do that.
It was so fucking annoying, and it wasn't like a couple of words, like it was long passages, and then it would just be like, you know, moving on. It's like, no, I'm not with you.
Yeah,
I don't know what point you just made.
I really wish it was just a standard to have the original and the translation side by side.
Yes.
Because particularly with Plautus, I want to see like the original language of the curse words. So sometimes like in his comedies, if an article is using like the translation first, I'm like, all right. But when he says that there, like, what was he specifically saying? Because right now you're just calling him a dick. Like, is that, what is the...
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and it's like in the effort to make everything like simple and easy to understand, I think we lose a lot of like the original meaning. and the nuance of the language, which is a shame. But I also like don't, I wouldn't understand it anyway, even if I saw it. So.
In this work, essentially the mention that we get, someone is insulting a cook, saying that eating their food is like having strigas eat your organs and shorten your lifespan. So,
wow.
That is a great roast.
Gordon yes, Ramsay level.
So that's one way that we get a connection to them being kind of cannibalistic. So not only from the original myth, but also like they are these birds that will eat your insides. So that's what I'm comparing this to. Another Greek reference comes from Titinius, where we get a slightly different version of these Strix as a bird who lactates into the mouths of babies.
Delish.
Love it. You can prevent this by tying garlic to your child.
Okay.
Does that make the children monstrous in some way? Getting lactated?
I couldn't find anywhere where it specifically said what was happening, but the passage we get it in, because Titinius is another one of those manuscripts that it gets preserved in like somebody else's stuff. That person is... throws that in while talking about children teething and like things you can do to ease like the teething pain in children. It's like, by the way, like this weird bird creature will sometimes lactate into the mouths of your babies. If that happens, garlic.
Garlic.
So I'm guessing it's got to be painful in some way if they connect those two pains in the literature.
That's what I was going to say. I was like, oh, If the baby's crying a lot, it might be drinking like this nasty milk from the weird creature.
Yeah. I think the connection to garlic is neat because we're going to talk about vampires and stuff. But in my head, I like to imagine that they didn't tie garlic to the kid. I like to imagine that they like slather the baby in garlic, like just season the baby in garlic.
Season it up real good.
But also Wikipedia, just throwing this out there, translates that whole thing really weird, that it's not that they lactate into the mouths of babies. They say the birds squirt milk into the baby's mouths, which I don't like. I physically cringe at the choice of words there.
Like a torpedo situation.
Yeah, I don't like it. But then another book said that the Strix milk themselves into the baby's lips. And I'm like, that's not better.
No, it's not.
I don't like any of these words that any of you chose. Ovid, finally moving on to him, in 8 AD, describes strigas as large-headed birds with transfixed eyes, rapacious beaks, grayish-white wings, and hooked claws who disembowel children and eat them.
Yum.
Lovely. There is a bit of a question in his work as to whether strigas are part of nature or whether strigas are hags who turn into birds through magic.
Okay.
So that's where we start to get some interesting like connotations of like old women being brought into this whole mess. So
right.
We'll see how things start to get mixed up. He relates the story of Proca or Procas. I don't know how to say it.
The Latin king, like Procas.
Yeah, yeah, him. Exactly him. Thank you for knowing who I'm referencing, Ballard.
I told you he would tell us how to pronounce things.
Him, who as a baby was attacked by strigas who scarred his cheeks and discolored his complexion.
Yikes.
Oof.
And the strigas were kept away by a nymph who performed a ritual with a magic wand to keep out evil.
That's nifty.
Yes. It's in Petronius Arbiter's Satyricon during the reign of Nero. So contemporary to you guys, that we get mention of strigas as night hags and a story of them carrying off a boy. All of this to say that you can see how the Strix influenced the idea of what a witch was. We have a bunch of things that sound very similar to accusations that have come up in trials on the show. Transformation into animals, flying, carrying kids off, sucking blood, cannibalism. This is all stuff that we've talked about very recently. They're all things from our unofficial bingo card.
Right.
In some episodes, we've talked about witches and vampirism and how tied those two things can be. So it's probably not surprising that the Strix is also connected to vampires. The Latin striga, meaning evil, spirit, witch, hag, vampire, however you want to translate it, is strega in Italian, or witch. In Romanian, striga is scream, which important because like banshee, owl, that kind of connotation.
Yeah.
Striguaica is a female vampire, and strigua is a male vampire.
Okay.
And then striga, again, is also barn owl. So you got vampires and owls there. In Albania, you have the striga, a blood-sucking witch. And in Slavic folklore, you have the striga, which is a demon similar to the vampire, which is usually female. And this is by no means an all-inclusive look at the Strix or vampire creatures, but hopefully it gives you a little bit of a gist of how connected witches and vampires and owls for some reason are.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I got for you today.
Near the end especially, it was reminding me of the story of Lilith, the female demon kind of creature in the Hebrew Bible. I have a cat toy, sorry. It's a Woody Woodpecker. I was just messing around with it. And then I'm like, there's a lot of similarities there too. And I never thought about like, so they compare her to creatures in the book and they're like, oh, she is like a creature, but she also hangs out with creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Like the jackals and stuff and like night animals. It's very cool that it's all kind of like in every culture, there's something like this. And why is it always a woman? What's going on there?
So the Strix wails like a banshee, right? That was in one of the earlier sources.
Mm-hmm. It screams at night.
I wonder if it's because of like the funerary practices. That's part of what.
That's interesting.
It's the woman's body to, or woman's body. It's the woman's job to anoint the body. Anoint the body for death. You know, mourn by wailing was the traditional thing. And
keening.
If you didn't have and if you didn't have your family to do it, you could hire professional keeners.
I always wanted to go into that profession.
I would be so good at it.
Scream at a stranger's funeral.
God, I would be perfect at that.
I would
job.
Do it for free.
You need a whole like theater troupe in like a Roman context, because you also need people to put on the masks of the dead and pretend to be them as you go down the parade. So it's like a whole production.
Right.
Sarah, career change. This is what we're doing now.
I love that for us.
Places,
let's
people.
Do it. Just unholy shriek. I love it.
You can imagine, like, what if you're not used to it yet? Like, you're young and you see these women tearing their hair out and screaming and you just lost your dad or whatever the hell. You can imagine it would become, like, terrifying imagery.
Right.
And then, you know, you grow up a little bit later and you get a little sexist and you're like, you know what? I bet those bitches are eating children.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, I never thought about it that way. You're like, oh, like the people who were traumatized by it as children and then grow up to write bad things about the women who did it and make up stories about them.
Or even if foreigners witness it and they're like, what the fuck is this weird practice?
Yeah.
Like, if some weirdo showed up at like my grandma's funeral and just started screaming, I would write shit about that on Facebook.
Yeah, they would be removed from the situation. Like, that would be really uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's cool. That gives me something to think about and maybe research.
Okay, so I am going to tell a story. I'm just doing it off the dome. I'm going to tell a story from what I mentioned, my favorite part of Roman history. And it's actually kind of a dry run for me because next semester I get to make my own course about Nero. So I'm pretty happy about it. Yeah.
Wow.
I got 20 students signed up.
Nice.
Signed up after we, there's some restructuring. So some things are happening last minute. So I just recently took over the course and 10 of the students signed up after that. So nice. I'm pretty pumped about it.
I want to take that class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is like a preview.
This is a preview. This is a dry on. This is a practice. And we're talking about one of the first things I want to do is I genuinely, in addition to being interesting, I genuinely think that the Nero story lets you see a lot of different like key features and points. One of which is like the role of women, because his mother has one of the most impressive careers of any sort of woman in Roman politics. And maybe the most, I mean, it flames out horribly, but you know, that's par for the course. So in, you know, Roman historical literature, you essentially see two stock types of females over and over, a suffering virgin type, like Lavinia or, well, in one story.
I thought you were going to say like Liz. Sorry.
In one story concerning the sort of struggle between the orders, she's just called Virginia, which is not subtle. It's just, and then you see the horrible poisoning, mannish, power hungry, yada, yada. Mm. And the interesting thing about Agrippina the Younger, which is the mother of Nero, who, if there's any context needed, he's the fifth emperor in the Roman Empire, takes power about 54 and then continues until 68.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother was the sister of Caligula. And his three sisters were paraded around and sort of symbols of the regime. And there were all sorts of rumors that he was involved with all or particularly one of them. And eventually he turns on them for some reason. The official reason is that they're sleeping with dudes and conspiring behind his back to replace him.
Mm-hmm.
So he kills Agrippina's lover. And when his body's burned and put into an urn, she is forced to carry it down the streets. Sort of like and maybe this is what inspired it, sort of like a Circe type scene, just sort of being shamed down Rome, mm-hmm. all the way to the road. And she's exiled for a while. After Caligula dies, she claws her way back to power by marrying her biological uncle.
Love that. Solid.
Yep. You gotta love it. After his first wife has her own flame out, political flame out. And the rumors are, of course, that she seduced and then poisoned him. What we factually know, because we have, you know, we have sculptures and coins and stuff where she's putting her face and Nero's face on the iconography, and she just sons Claudius. Claudius is the emperor that she married to get in this position. She sons his biological son so hard, where he has a title where he's like a little junior title, and then she gives Nero the big boy title and just supplants him really hard. She's accused of poisoning Claudius. Maybe he just died because he was old as hell, whatever. And she puts Nero in power, but it's fairly clear she's the one, you know, calling the shots for a while.
Yeah.
And during that period, Nero doesn't act out too much. The most famous atrocities of his are later, although
most famous atrocities.
It's a long list.
First atrocities, they weren't so bad. They were like mild atrocities.
It was. The first thing what he was said to be doing in his early years when he was a young, you know, he was just a teenager when he takes power,
mm-hmm.
is he would dress up like a pauper, and his other homies would dress up like paupers. Some of them would be other aristocrats, but some of them would be like a chariot driver or a gladiator or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go out on the town and beat and or assault people. And just that was just what they did, is just put on a disguise, roll out. And most people kind of knew and just didn't do anything. There is a story that one senator did not realize who it was and beat the ever-loving fuck out of him.
Mm.
And that guy, of course, had to kill himself later because...
Oh my God.
You can't survive that. You can't.
Wait, I think you wrote about that. Like, he punched a dude in the face at the bar and it turned out to be Nero.
Yep.
That's hilarious.
Yep.
I mean, not supposedly. So much for him, but for me it is.
Supposedly Nero wasn't going to kill him until the idiot wrote a letter apologizing. He was like, well, now it's out in the open, guy. Like, you, if we could have kept this secret just between us.
Now everybody knows I got my ass kicked.
So. Yeah, you can't.
By a peasant.
During those 5 years, the reign is genuinely pretty stable and successful. That's why decades later, Trajan, who's very overrated, but is considered a very good emperor, says no one ever had a better 5 years than Nero in his first time. And by most accounts, he wasn't doing anything. He was making public appearances. It was Agrippina and the people she put in power, which were Burrus, this old military type. In my book, I sort of gave him the voice of an old basketball coach, because I imagined him just yelling for decades. And that's why he has that hoarse voice. Yeah. It sounds like they're in pain all the time. If you just want to look up a clip of the current Philadelphia 76ers coach, you're going to... That man sounds like he's in the bad shape.
Wait, now I want to look it up.
And also Seneca was the person she hired to teach Nero, teach him how to make good speeches and whatnot. And also he's running things behind the scenes and he's getting very rich, but we don't have time for that, okay. That whole thing. Where the breaking point seemed to come is... For one thing, Agrippina started doing a little too much, where early iconography, she and Nero are sort of on two different sides of a coin, or you'll see her like crowning him essentially, which is already a little iffy, right? She is bestowing power, which puts her in a very high up position, but he is still wearing the crown, so we're not too bad. We are told that she starts to change protocol a little bit, to sort of try to put herself on like a chair as high as Nero's, or perhaps there without him. Mm-hmm. And that is not okay with the the established elite and all that. We are also told that Nero falls in love with a slave woman within the imperial household, and he wants to free and marry her. He has some documents forged to say that she's not a common slave, she's the descendant of a princess from right. And she is not having that, because he's been married to his sister, Claudius's daughter, and that is what's securing the dynasty, right? And also it's scandalous to marry a slave, so she is very upset with that, and that is when he sort of loses favor with her, that she's not letting him do what he wants, right? So she starts slowly getting pushed out of power after this period. There's an instance where she tries to assert herself by sitting on the chair coming up to him, breaking protocol, and Seneca like hurriedly motions for Nero to walk up and stop her and sort of greet her, so it publicly looks polite, but he's also very much preventing her from where she wants to go. She supposedly hatches a plot to put that little bitch guy, Claudius's biological son, supposedly hatches a plot to replace him. His name is Britannicus, replace Nero with him. That guy gets axed. And she just kind of dwindles in power for a little bit. And then we get the same, he doesn't end up marrying Acte, the slave girl. He falls in love with one of his friend's wives, Poppaea Sabina, who is a famous beauty. He ends up exiling that friend so he can marry her.
Oh my God.
Not exile, but he gave him a position like, you get to have a job over in Spain. Way over there.
Classic.
Yeah. And this is another thing. Agrippina's, apparently throwing a fit about him destroying the stable marriage, yada, yada. So he's like, all right, I need to be rid of this, right? I just need to kill her. He's nervous about doing it directly because people kind of looked the other way when he killed his brother, cousin person, because that's just sort of par for the
brother,
course.
Brother, cousin.
It's par for the course in politics. But the mother, like a matricide, that is not a common thing.
Right.
And that is like a famously, there's a whole three plays about Orestes being haunted for killing his mother.
Right.
That's that is a hard line to cross. It's also the fact that she is at that point the last surviving child of a really famous general named Germanicus, who helped stabilize a really, really difficult region where the Germans are, and they're really buff and they're scary. Mm-hmm. So he is very nervous about directly ordering her killed, and he's trying to think of a way around it. So the story is that one day he goes to a play, and the Romans were very, industrious, very engineer savvy people. So even on their plays, they had these really elaborate props. Sometimes they would just burn a whole house down on stage when they were doing a burning house in a play. Mm-hmm. There was a play in which a shipwreck was shown on stage, and they had built a prop ship that at the pull of a lever would break in half. Mm-hmm. And he was like, he got him an idea, right? So during a festival of Minerva, actually, he goes down to the Roman equivalent of, Miami or something, the Bay of Naples. And he invites her over to have a dinner and like a reconciliation, right? So far, I skipped over the rumors that he was sleeping with her because, you know, that's just, you know, another thing that is attached to any ambitious women is that they're sleeping with anyone, including their own son, to get
married. Right.
Sort of skipped over that fact. But once upon a time, they had a close relationship. And he claims he's going to reconcile at this beach house. So they have dinner. It's a very long dinner. And it's supposedly it is quite, you know, emotional, and he keeps it lingering. He orders more lamps to be brought in because he's sort of hesitant to let it go. But in the end they say goodbye. She gets on this ship that he had given her as a gift, this very luxurious ship. Everyone was, you know, peacocking essentially in the Bay of Naples with their ships, mm-hmm. pimping their ships out. So she gets on the ship. They start a sailing along. One of the sailors pulls the lever and it doesn't work. it doesn't seem to work initially. It's sort of shuddering, and not all the members of the crew are on board, are aware mm-hmm. of what's going on. So they're trying to stop him. So it turns into a whole mess, a whole fight. Eventually the ship is going down, and I've never been sure how I'm supposed to read this detail. And I've gone back and forth on whether or not I want to use this character. One of her servants, Agrippina's servant, she jumps up and said, or when they're both in the water, she goes up and says, "I'm Agrippina." And then they beat her to death with oars. Hmm. And I've never been sure if she knows what's going on and she's sacrificing herself, or if she doesn't know and she's trying to get saved, but her mistress is going to die.
So it's like Spartacus.
Yeah. I've never been sure which way it is.
Hmm.
Really interesting.
And they just beat the fuck out of her.
They beat the ever loving shit out of her.
Wow.
I've toyed with using the version where she does try to sacrifice and have her show up back again later out for revenge. And she basically has like a giant swollen, like a poorly healed occipital bone and all that shit. I've toyed with that, you know. It'd be interesting.
I would read about that character.
Oh yeah.
There's so many people worth including, but I'm not sure which ones. But Agrippina survives, makes it to the shore. She stays at the house of a friend, and she makes sort of a similar mistake, but she basically tries to bluff her way out of things by sending a letter to Nero saying, "There was an accident. I'm glad, you know, it was great to see you. I'm okay, don't worry." Basically just trying to pretend like she didn't notice so they could hopefully like move on and go. But Nero is not having that. As soon as her messenger shows up, he throws a dagger on the ground and says, "She sent someone to kill me." So they kill the messenger, and then they send some guards over. Burrus will not send his soldiers because they're still terrified of they're nervous about the loyalty of the army. They still don't want to send someone out. So a freedman, a former slave that Nero put in charge of the navy, he goes with his guys instead, with his just, you know, random soldiers and street toughs essentially. And Nero says, you know, it's come to this that I get my emperorship handed to me by a former slave or something. So they show up, she knows what time it is, and she bares her stomach and says, "Strike here where the monster came from," basically.
Whoa.
Pretty dope. It's pretty dope. She's got some dope.
I have a new role model.
Yeah. It's
pretty cool. She goes down swinging, and she does, of course, die. And he was supposed to have been haunted by her ghost. And he hired several sorcerers to try and get rid of the ghost. So I've been doing some research in ancient Roman magic and such, as one does. Mm-hmm. And the way you get rid of a ghost is sort of interesting. Exorcism of like a daemon will look very familiar. In a pagan world, it looks pretty similar to what you hear Jesus doing in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Call the thing out by its name. It'll resist at first. You call it in the name of a divine power and bring it out, right? That's exorcism looks fairly similar. But actually purifying like a haunting spirit is a little different. There's some part of the ritual is very similar to what you do for when someone is lost at sea. If someone dies and you can't get the body, you will call their spirit three times to a cenotaph, which is essentially a grave in absentia, where the spirit can rest even though we don't have the body. Mm-hmm. That'll involve some circular motions. There's always a circular motion in any calling of the dead evocation in these pagan rituals. So you'll sort of call them three times, make the circle, and then you'll some kind of sacrifice to seal the deal, essentially. And you have to do something fairly similar if you're getting rid of an evil spirit. It's slightly different if you know the name versus if you don't. Obviously, he knows the name in this case. If you don't know the name, you have to do something with like two dolls, where you take a male and female doll and you sort of host a picnic for them, essentially. Try and draw the spirit into the doll. The reason
okay.
to take a male and a female doll is because you don't know who the ghost is.
Right.
So you have one for either. So you need to call the doll in first, and then once you have the doll there, then you move on to the core of the ritual, which is essentially, and we have some instructions. One of these sources basically gives you instructions for how to get rid of a ghost. So from 460 BC, we have some sacred writing from Salinas, the place, not the person. And it was talking about how you basically meet with the ghost, and everything is on their terms. Like you wait till the ghost is ready and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You call on the ghost wherever he wants, and at whatever point in the year he wants, and in whatever month he wants, and on whatever day he wants. Like it's over and over, sort of emphasizing that you follow the ghost's wishes. You welcome the ghost and give it water for washing the hands, bread and wine. You give salt to the same ghost. You sacrifice a piglet to Zeus from it, and then turn in a circle around it. Only then, after you've done all this, you can address the ghost. You may eat and sleep. Sometimes it's unclear whether you're talking about the ghost or the person. Eat and sleep wherever he wants. If someone wants to be purified of the attacking ghost or someone outside of his family, he is to be purified in the same way as a murderer when he is purified of his attacking ghost. So a lot of this is sort of assuming that you killed someone, which is what's happening in Nero's case, and you're trying to be rid of the ghost.
Okay.
But then if you can also, a very common thing in Christ tablets is you would go to someone who'd been recently buried, drop a tablet with instructions, and send them against your enemies. Whether that's in business, you have a rival shopkeeper, whether that's in court, you want someone, to shut the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
Snitches get ghosts, apparently. or sometimes you also call on a ghost for help with a love spell. So you meet with the ghost, you try to propitiate them. You don't need to do anything with the corpse. Even if there's a haunting that seems to have been done because someone wasn't properly buried, you still don't need to dig up the body. There's stories of sages, they're able to, whether they're associated with a religious order or they're just philosophical sages, they're able to find where the body is, but they don't dig up. And obviously the cynic in me says, well, good thing they didn't need to dig up and prove that they know where the body is, right?
Right.
They just perform a ritual over the spot rather than do anything to actually improve the burial condition.
Right.
but it's essentially sort of a meal and a reconciliation. That's what you do after the fact. If you're a smart murderer, and you don't want to have to deal with this, you have the option to do something called maskilisthmos or maskilisthenes, which is armpitting. And it refers to cutting the limbs off of ghosts and hanging them under the armpit. When you kill someone, first you wipe the blood on their own forehead or in their hair. Then you dismember them so that they don't have the ability to come after you. The idea is that the ghost will have the form of the corpse. Right. So you want to get rid of their arms, their legs, possibly their tongue too, which is what Achilles is sort of threatening to do to Hector way back in the Iliad. It's just sort of, you won't have eyes or a tongue and that sort of thing. If I'm remembering that part right.
Yeah.
But there's an idea that if you mutilate the ghost, you sort of handicap them at first before they have a chance with this. But if you're not smart enough to do that first, then you essentially have to break bread with the ghosts in a similar way that you would to sort of like a living enemy. And that's the way it is, which I think is really interesting because it's not imposing the power, your power on the ghost. It's not sort of, you know, calling them out and with a big like flash of light. It's like, you know, let's try to work something out, essentially.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, really cool.
It is cool.
It's funny that the two options are so different. It's like, you can either dismember this corpse so that the ghost is just completely unable to do anything, mm-hmm. or you can be nice to it.
Or you can have a picnic.
Yeah, have a picnic. It's pretty hilarious.
Lovely picnic. And it's like,
And the murderer after killing someone is like, I've had a really hard day. I'm not up to like disarticulating this corpse. And I could really go for a picnic right now. So
right.
I could really go for a flaky baguette right now.
So presumably that's what he would have tried to have done, is break bread with the ghosts. But we know that years later, when he went to Greece and he was going to take part in the Eleusinian Mysteries, anyone who was impure is barred from doing it, and he just stayed away. He did not enter. He was nervous.
Not yeah. pure enough.
Supposedly he had nightmares just for an indeterminate amount of time, but possibly the rest of his life, and for just haunting him and just the guilt of doing that.
Good for her.
Good for her, really. She did. She flew higher than almost any other, and arguably any other woman, because, you know, Augustus's wife Livia wasn't really getting like the great titles and stuff to her name. She was more sort of, anything she was doing was more sort of behind the scenes. So arguably, she had the most high profile career.
Yeah, she was awesome.
She was pretty dope, and she did have to claw her way back right from exile. So it is a really cool story in that way.
But she girl boss too close to the sun. So.
Too close to the sun.
As
too
all our ladies sun, do.
Literally.
Oh, hey. There we go. You belong on this podcast.
I'm having a blast, honestly. I do want to say real quick, the most interesting thing, or the most interesting story that I read in this book, which is filled with as many sort of primary source ghost stories and sorcerer stories and all that. I say recurring theme. There's only like two or three examples, but a rule of thumb in ancient archaeology is you assume there's a lot more because you only find so much, right? Mm-hmm. There's sort of a recurring theme where ghosts will try to fuck the living people. And it's sometimes, it follows the same pattern as like, I'm blanking, Orpheus and Eurydice, where you do the one last thing and it ruins the person coming back. There's a story of an innkeeper's daughter who had passed away at a tragically young age. And then there was one guy staying at the inn who had a real pep in his step because this girl kept showing up at his room and they were banging, essentially. They were making love. And I forget the exact detail. He figures out at some point that it's the ghost of the innkeeper's daughter. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh no. And he's, and it's implied that if they stopped after that, and it's implied that had they not, she would have been able to essentially suck the life out of him and come back to life. But they stop it on like the last night before that happens. But there's like one or two stories like that.
So do they say that that's like her goal as the ghost?
I need to find it again. I don't know if it was her goal or if it was something that would have just sort of naturally.
Right.
I think it probably was her goal.
Not to put you on the spot.
No, that's all right. I mean, I can look for just a minute. Yeah, it is her. It is her. It is her intention. She's the one who says, "Ah, you really screwed me up."
Wow, that's really cool. I love that.
I want to know the first ghost to figure that out and then pass it on to everybody.
He's like, "Hey, everybody!
Just fuck everybody, yourself we're all gonna back get to laid life.
And come back to life.
Fuck yourself back to life." Oh God!
You could imagine like a ghost health book going around the underworld.
Right.
Sleep your way back to life.
Sleep your way to the top, literally.
Had that man died from sleeping with her, would he have been a ghost that could have also fucked himself back to life?
Could they just trade off forever?
Just keep it. They each have a year.
Wait, like, this is so good.
That's like a solid romance, honestly.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Like if they knew each other before, well, they don't even have to know each other before. And what if they fall in love, right? And she feels awful when it's done, and when it's nearly done, and she sort of confesses or something. And he's like, "Oh, I forgive you." And then when the year comes around, he comes back, and she's just like, "I know how I can make this right."
But you know what? You could turn it into a tragedy, because what if they just wait for that meeting again, and then the other one never shows up because they died elsewhere during the year?
Yeah.
Oh no! But they were enemies first. They were enemies first.
That's gotta be.
Oh my god!
Enemies to lovers. Yes. Why do we always write weird shit on this podcast?
We always end up coming up with like a script for a movie or something.
Yes, we do.
Like the gunpowder plot. Like we're gonna make the gunpowder plot as a comedy movie.
I mean, it is a bumbling.
It's fucking hilarious.
It's so fucking funny.
That one, and you know, the attempted assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand went so wrong so many times. if not for the ending, that would be a fantastic madcap comedy. Because they screwed it up so hard.
Yeah.
And then he just happens to be having lunch in the same place later.
Right.
If I remember right. He goes to get coffee, and then Ferdinand's just walking by because he's visiting the victims of the bomb they threw that just bounced off the car and hit random people.
It just goes to show you should never try and plan your assassinations. Honestly, for an opportunity.
The bow didn't work.
Yep.
It just never works.
Yep. Your gunpowder.
You'll know when the time is right. Just be yourself and trust that
serendipity will lead the way.
Yeah.
Aww, that's heartwarming.
Talking about assassination.
Yeah, but it's like, be yourself, do your best. It's positive.
Nice. That was good. That was fun.
That was good. Yeah. Good job. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about an event during the shift from pagan Rome to Christian Rome that happened during Nero's rule, specifically the Great Fire of Rome. So we'll look at the fire itself and also at some of the first martyrs of the Church of Rome, which is the official name for the early Christians that Nero executed. So it was really fun researching, because it's always fun to see like people in the Bible actually have lives outside of the Bible, like their lives go on after their narrative in the Bible is over. I love that. I did get some primary sources, or I guess technically secondary, but I also did have to rely on a lot of like tertiary web sources like Wikipedia, unfortunately. So the background of like tension between Roman pagans and Christians in the decades following the death of Jesus is where I'll start. The transition from paganism to Christianity in Rome was a slow process, and it had already begun before Jesus was even born. So when the Roman Empire was established, religion was inextricable from daily life and politics. And it wasn't a question of belief. It wasn't like, do you believe in God? Like, do you believe in the gods? Like, that wasn't the focus. It wasn't like personal and introspective. It was more like, do you respect the ancestral customs? Are you behaving in a way that your ancestors would want you to behave in? If not, the officials in the Roman Senate would not really be your friend. They didn't want to associate with you. And it was very localized. Different communities focused on different deities and rituals. So as the Roman Empire grew and grew, the need for religious unity grew stronger and stronger. We have this vast expanse of land and territory, all these people with different customs. How are we going to connect them all? And it turned out that Roman society was very permeable in terms of religious practices. They allowed certain gods to be kind of like folded into their religion, like the Egyptian Isis, for example. So the exception to the permeability came when the religion potentially being adopted, or the deity attempting to be adopted, was seen as a threat to Roman identity. So again, it's like political, nationalistic, not like, oh, that's heretical. There's no real like idea of like heresy, for example. So it's a conflict of practice. For example, obviously we know that like the Romans imported, a nice way of saying it, imported a lot of deities from the Greek religion, including Dionysus, whom they called Bacchus, and like Bacchanalia, those festivals. So originally those were a-okay, like they're acceptable, but then it turns into like, oh, these guys are meeting at night alone in secret. They're probably plotting against the emperor. So we need to like shut down that practice. So it's the terms of the religious practice that are where we draw the line. So this is a good thing to keep in mind when we start talking about like why Christianity was treated with such like hostility. So why was that happening? What was going on? Well, we have to start with Judaism, because Christianity is obviously an offshoot of Judaism. They come from the same tradition. Interestingly, Judaism was a-okay for the most part for a long time in the Roman Empire. The main reason for that was it was respected because it was so old, like such an ancient tradition. So it was seen as like respecting the customs of your elders, which is what the Romans were all about. But there were periodic expulsions of Jews and other groups that the Romans didn't particularly love, like the Druids or the astrologers. Every now and then, they would get kicked out of the city. And then whenever there was a new emperor, they could come back. That's kind of how it worked. So, and of course, when Jesus showed up, it just made it even weirder. Like, Jesus made everybody uncomfortable.
I bet. Some of the shit he did is like a kid and everything's like, okay, what a weird little child.
Right. He like makes pigs talk and like frogs crawl out of the well and stuff. Like, ooh, this kid, there's something up. So Jesus showed up during the reign of Claudius, who we mentioned was the emperor before Nero. So about 10 years before Claudius expels all the Jews from Rome, he writes a letter to citizens in the city of Alexandria saying that Jewish people are no longer allowed to meet in synagogues, and warns them to not accept any new Jewish people into their city. He calls them a plague infecting the whole world, which is fun and chill.
Not harsh at all.
No. So the historian Suetonius, I think that's how you pronounce it.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. Thank you. He makes the connection between Claudius's discomfort about the Jews. He connects it to Jesus. So he calls Jesus Crestus with an E. Yeah. Which to me, I was like, that sounds like full Alabama. Like, my cousin Crestus. he calls him Crestus. So 10 years after Claudius writes this letter, like I said, he goes on to expel all the Jews from Rome. And Suetonius says this is because, quote, the Jews constantly made disturbances at the instigation of Crestus. So he goes on to describe the Jews who follow this guy named Crestus as engaging in something called superstitio, which obviously that sounds like the word superstition, but it has a much harsher connotation than our modern association with superstition, which is like, oh, harmless, ignorant belief. Not so in the Roman Empire. The connotations would be like excessive religious devotion. And he calls this superstition mischievous. That's how it's translated. But really, it's the word maleficus, which means either magic or magician. So he's probably accusing them of practicing black magic. So it is not like a light chill making fun of them. It's very serious. And then you add in the extra like cultural violation that these Christians are like distancing, they're breaking with the ancestral Jewish tradition. And it's like, this is not going to go well. These people are not going to be respected in Roman society. This is dangerous and radical what they're doing. Anyway, Jews are expelled from Rome by Claudius. And then there's evidence of this expulsion in the Bible. So I'm going to read that passage, which will help me transition into talking about some of the saints. And then the saints will bring us back to Rome to talk about the fire. So the passage comes from the book of the Acts of the Apostles. And right now we're talking about the Apostle Paul. For anyone who is not familiar with Paul, here's a brief overview of his hero's journey. I don't have time to get into a lot of detail about like his theology, but he was originally named Saul. He is called the Apostle Paul, but he was not one of the original 12 OGs. He was a Pharisee, so he was part of the establishment that Jesus was actively preaching against. He would have called Paul like a hypocrite. And that he was abusing his power, basically. So Paul's conversion story is very famous. He was on the road to Damascus to arrest Christians and bring them back to Jerusalem to be like tried and executed when there was a blinding flash of white light and Christ appeared to him, the risen Christ. So he was converted, he was baptized, and he took the name Paul, which means humble. So after his conversion, he was the one who wrote all the letters to the citizens of different cities. So when you hear like, oh, this is from the book of Corinthians, it's actually called like St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians. So all of that stuff, that's all Paul. So he would travel all over the place to these cities. He would preach there. He would try to convert people, Jewish people, Greek people, everybody. And he would write them these letters. So as you can imagine, the reception that he got was often very negative because he would go around saying things like, oh, you don't have to pay taxes to the king because he's not really a king because Jesus is the one true king and everything you know is wrong. So like he stirred up trouble wherever he went. So he was constantly getting like booted out of cities and he would move on to the next one. So in one of these cases, he is preaching in Athens. He gets kicked out. So he goes to the Greek city of Corinth and he meets a famous biblical couple. So chapter 18 of Acts says, he's in Corinth and it says there he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. He went to visit them and because he practiced the same trade, stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. So he meets Priscilla and Aquila, this married couple who are refugees from Rome, and he ends up living with them and like becoming really good friends with them. So who are Priscilla and Aquila? Like, who are these randos? The bad news is we don't really know. We only have a few very short mentions of them in the Bible. Like each time they come up, it's like half a sentence. So in one passage, they correct like a newly converted Christian preacher. They pull him aside after he's preaching and they tell him like, no, you really got this part about baptism wrong. That's not really how it works. So that's one story about them in the Bible. So obviously we know they are engaging with the community, the new Christian community. They are knowledgeable about their theology, but we don't know much else. So they're always mentioned together whenever they come up, which is very cute. It's very much married couple vibes. And we know that they traveled with Paul. So in Corinthians, he says, the churches of Asia send you greetings. Aquila and Priscilla, together with the church at their house, send you many greetings in the Lord. And then in Romans, he says, greet Priscilla and Aquila, my co-workers in Christ Jesus, who risk their necks for my life, to whom not only I am grateful, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. So he references like church houses, where in the early church, what will later be known as Mass is celebrated in people's homes. Just like it, like after the Reformation in England, we see that happening. And the English sources, the Catholics will compare themselves to the early church because they're also like doing it in secret for fear of execution. So the last thing we know about Priscilla and Aquila is that they came back to Rome in the year 53 when Claudius died and Nero took over and the expulsion edict was lifted because Paul mentions them in his letter to the Romans. So now we transition back to Rome. So if this would be a good time to go if you have to.
Okay.
So we say goodbye to our lovely guest, David Ballard.
Right when it's getting good.
Right when it's getting good. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
We would love to have you back at some point.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Cool. It's a deal.
All right. Thank you.
Literally left right when it was getting good. I was trying to go so fast. Like I'm so out of breath.
I could tell. And I was like, I'm not going to interrupt to make any jokes. She's trying so hard.
I was, but now it's fine. Now I can chill the fuck out. Yeah. So we go back to Rome. Priscilla and Aquila and Paul go to Rome in the year 53. When Claudius dies. This is bad news because now there's no one here to correct me if I say something wrong. I had really counted on someone knowing like when my pronunciations were really bad. Oh well, it'll be fun. He'll tell us when he listens. So now that we're back in Rome, let's talk about the fire. As we know, as Ballard told us, Nero reigned from 54 to 68 AD and was the last of the Julio-Claudian dynasty. We've heard about how he had his mother murdered. He just generally was unliked in his time and pretty unlikable. And I guess now he's still very unliked, although I kind of like him just because he's so like chaotic and unhinged. I weirdly find that really inspiring. Suetonius and Tacitus, the Roman historians, are sometimes thought of as they're not really objective about Nero because they lived at the same time as him, so they directly were affected by his bullshit. But I am going to quote from them because they're good sources. At least they're interesting. Suetonius lists various laws that Nero put into effect that definitely contributed to why he was so unliked. At one point, he outlawed chariot races and pantomime shows to try and maintain order in the city, like in the effort to maintain some kind of order, because he was not a good emperor. He just shut down like all the fun. It's like that one kid who, when they're not winning at the board game, just like destroys it.
My brother just changed the rules. The second that he was a couple points behind, it's like, okay, this is how we're going to play the game now.
Yeah, that's exactly Nero, 100%. Yes. It's just like the spoiled rich kid who hates losing. Not that your brother's a spoiled rich kid. That's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. Anyway, where was I? What am I talking about? So he wanted to stop all the fun except for obviously his own fun. So he would undertake these like massively extravagant construction projects for himself, like financed by his people's taxes. So he built an amphitheater, he built himself a new palace, like, which we'll get to. To be fair, he was only 16 years old when he became emperor. His brain was clearly not fully developed. And he was more popular among the lower classes because he put money into things like amphitheaters and athletic events that like lower class people would attend. So his reign was not all negative, but he gets a really bad rap with Tacitus and Suetonius, and a lot of it seems to come from the fire. So here's what happened. Fires in Rome at this time were common. It was not unheard of for like a merchant shop or whatever, or somebody's house to just like spontaneously combust, which is a terrifying way to live. In the year 6, which is a funny thing to say.
The year six.
After a particularly nasty fire, Emperor Augustus introduced an organization called the Cohort Vigilis. See, it would have helped to know if that was really off the mark, but it's fine. They're basically the police. It means police. So that's what I'll call them. They were a group of freedmen who would guard the city during the night, and it was their job to put out fires if there were any.
So they were police and firemen.
They were police and firemen, which I kind of think we should just have firemen, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever said, fuck the firefighters. they were police and firemen. And then, so they have these guys. And of course, one of the things that ancient Rome is really famous for, like what I think about when I think about ancient Rome, is the aqueducts. So I never really understood why the city could burn down or how the city could burn down if they had these like marvels of engineering aqueducts that could like distribute water wherever in the city. So they were very advanced for the time period, but they were advanced because they were remodeled after the Great Fire. So the Great Fire was what made the aqueducts what they were, like the marvel that they were. So it took this tragedy to happen for them to be instituted, which is like, that's how everything goes. Mm-hmm. It's always tragic in that way, where it's like, well, if only we would have had this 5 years earlier, it never would have happened. So like pre-Great Fire Rome is kind of like the Wild West. I was going to compare it to 9/11. Probably not a good idea. I meant like in
that's
my
where
head,
my brain was at though, whenever you're talking about right? things changing. I'm like, yeah, that's when we had to have a terrorist attack to get like the TSA and all that yep. stuff and the new rules. It took a pandemic for us to like start getting better at teaching things online and having events mm-hmm. online, which was not really a big thing before.
No, it was not.
And now we've like made the technology to do that better. We've made it more commonplace. So it always takes something big.
It does, which is unfortunate, but it takes being snapped out of your like daily routine where you're just like laser focused on like what's the bare minimum I need to do to survive today, to look at the big picture. And it takes like such a huge event to like pull you out of it. I was thinking my brain was on 9/11 because I was like, yeah, you can always tell before, like when shows were filmed before 9/11, because there's always that romantic moment where they run right up
run
to the airport
the
gate.
Every time they do that, I'm like, is that not illegal? Like, can you not do that?
Right. Yeah. But then post 9/11, they had to change everything. So that's why I went there, but I'm not officially comparing it to that. I know they're very different events. Before the Great Fire, the aqueducts did exist, but they were not properly equipped to fight fires. It was just a way to like transport water, like dirty water, out of the city, which in itself was pretty like mind-blowing that they were doing that back then. But so the firefighters, the police firefighters, would use like blankets, buckets of water. And if that didn't work, they would just demolish whatever structure was on fire.
Well, none of our efforts have panned out. Bring out the bulldozer.
I know it would be shitty if it was your house, but how fucking funny is that?
Where you just see like... them putting like the blankets and the pails of water down, and you're just like, wait, guys.
Wait, keep trying. Please keep trying.
Just bring out sledgehammers and start knocking your fucking house down.
It's like a little grease fire in your kitchen. They're like, well, we tried water, that made it worse. We tried a blanket, that didn't work, wasn't big enough.
Imagine if you get the group of people who really just didn't want to put out the fire like the easy way. So they just show up with the sledgehammers and knock everything down first. You're like, God damn it, I shouldn't have called anyone.
Right. Yeah. So they knocked down a bunch of houses. They just fucking demolished whatever was on fire in the worst case scenario. So again, what we know about the fire mainly comes from Tacitus, who was only 8 years old at the time of the fire.
And he's like, I remember it perfectly.
I remember
mind everything. Is like a steel trap.
Right. No, he's open that he used like public record to like reconstruct the story of what happened. He doesn't say like, yes, I remember it all.
That would be like me saying that I knew everything about 9/11 because I was in second grade when it happened.
I mean, I do very distinctly remember like snapshots.
I was in first grade when it happened.
Yeah. I remember the teachers all leaving and going to the teacher's lounge.
Yeah.
To watch it on TV. I remember
going home early.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, we'll just keep that in mind that he was 8 years old and this is like public record, whatever. So he tells us that the fire broke out in July of 64 on a hot and windy night, and that it started in a shop containing like flammable goods, maybe like candles or something. I don't know. Near the Circus Maximus, which was the chariot racing stadium. And from that district, it spread along like the really narrow streets and all the very close houses. And it just engulfed everything along the way. As it spread throughout the different districts, the citizens fled first to other areas of the city and then outside of the city. Meanwhile, Tacitus says that looters were actually fanning the flames and were throwing burning torches so that they could take advantage and rob people, or they were impeding the firefighters from putting out the fire. It's disputed if that happened, because now we actually know a lot more about how fires work. And we know that if they get large enough, they generate their own wind, which just exponentially increases their size. And so there's more oxygen. They create their own oxygen source because they get so big, there's a higher chance for embers to go in random places. So the idea of like people, oh, my house just spontaneously combusted. It wasn't even near the fire. Someone must have thrown a torch. It could have just been an ember. So we're not sure. The fire raged continuously for 6 days, stopped for a little while, and then reignited and burned for 3 more days.
They were like, we're in the clear. It's all good. And it started again.
Lola's right here, you fucking Brussels sprout. By the end of these 9 burning days, about 2/3 of the city was destroyed. 3 of the city's 14 districts were completely destroyed, and then another 7 were severely damaged.
And the emperor's like, I'm never going to financially recover from this.
literally. So like, what was public opinion on like the cause of the fire, and what the fuck was Nero doing while this all happened? Some Romans thought that the fire was just an accident. Like, of course, a city made of timber with like oil lamps as light sources is not gonna it's not gonna last
impervious long term.
No, I wouldn't say it's fireproof. So like, yeah, somebody's cow kicks over a lantern, whole city, sayonara. Like, it's possible it was just an accident. Other citizens were not so easygoing. They blamed Nero for the fire. One reason that's been theorized as to why Nero possibly could be at fault was that he was in the process of creating a backdrop for a theatrical production about the burning of Troy. And he wanted it to be very accurate, very historically accurate.
Yeah, we just talked with Ballard about them and their props.
I wish he was going to be here, because I was going to be like, oh, hey, because I was trying not to laugh when he brought that up about the ship. Because I was like, oh my God, that comes back in such a perfect way for the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually set the backdrop on fire. Not wise. If that's true, we don't know. If it is, it's kind of hilarious. Suetonius says it's something else. He says it's because Nero wanted to clear a bunch of space to build a new palace for himself called the Golden House. So to clear the space, he just burned down a bunch of people's houses and apartments. And the fire spread.
And then he had a bunch of space.
And then he had so much space. It was perfect. Nothing went wrong. It's interesting because Tacitus absolves Nero of responsibility for the fire. He says that Nero wasn't even in the city when the fire started. He was 35 miles away at one of his like villas or whatever. And so Tacitus says that when Nero learned of the fire, he returned to Rome and he organized relief efforts. So he says he even opened his palace and his gardens to refugees, and he distributed food to them. So Tacitus is like, it's not Nero's fault. He did his best. But he also tells us that Nero attempted to shift the blame for the fire off of himself and onto the Christians or the Christians. And Tacitus is the only one who makes this connection. Suetonius doesn't. And it's a connection that early church fathers echoed and continue to echo. So, for example, church father Tertullian wrote, "At Rome, Nero was the first who stained with blood the rising faith." So this accusation by Tacitus has definitely stuck. So here's what he has to say about the aftermath of the fire and how Nero tried to right everything. He says that they've tried everything. They've tried sacrifices to all the gods, they've held banquets, they've participated in rituals, but nothing is making the public opinion shift away from the idea that Nero started the fire, and people are really upset. So he says, quote, "But all human efforts, all the lavish gifts of the emperor and the propitiations of the gods did not banish the sinister belief that the conflagration was the result of an order. Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Crestus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Nero offered his gardens for the spectacle and was exhibiting a show in the circus while he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or stood aloft on a car. Hence, even for criminals who deserved extreme and exemplary punishment, there arose a feeling of compassion, for it was not as it seemed for the public good, but to glut one man's cruelty that they were being destroyed. And that's from the Annals of Tacitus, book 15. They're all digitized if you're interested in reading more. They're pretty cool, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think I've read from them before for one of the last stories that I did here. I love when they digitize stuff like that and make it so easy to get a hold of.
That's how everything should be. Literally every source we have should be digitized.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's really the closest thing we have to a primary source telling us what happened to the first martyrs of the Church of Rome. He doesn't tell us who was tortured and executed. He doesn't say much about what the trials were like, but he does note that they weren't so much executed for causing the fire. The fire was just kind of a convenient way to try and get rid of them, which I think is kind of like par for the course on this show. Like, oh, a natural disaster, a plague, a flood. It's just, this is a perfect way to get rid of the old lady that nobody likes who pees on people's front lawns.
Let's find the perfect scapegoat.
Yep, exactly. So I also like his inclusion of the idea that Nero's intention by blaming and executing the Christians was to like put everybody's mind at ease about the fire. But really it just made everyone more uncomfortable because what he did was so like inhumane and horrific. Like he made people into human torches and then like was riding around on a chariot, like, hooray, like giving wine to people and stuff while like human torches were burning. And everyone was just watching like, hooray.
All our homes are gone and now you're burning people. And now you're what? Burning people.
He's like, they started the fire. Everybody was like, I don't know why you thought this would convince us.
Or make us feel better.
Make us feel better about the kind of man who has power over every aspect of our lives. So I think Nero lacked the ability to like
read the room.
Exactly, that's what I had written down. He just couldn't do it. Something bad happened to him as a child, I think. Like, it just wasn't, he was never gonna do well in life. And he committed suicide at the age of 30. Like, it's a sad story, actually. And I do feel like he did the best he could with like the tools that he had and his family dynamic and everything. I don't know. Anyway, so to me, in trying to wrap up this story, leaving it there is not really satisfying. I wanted some answers. I wanted to know who the martyrs were. Like, were Priscilla and Aquila martyred? Were Peter and Paul martyred there? So like, what does the church say? But more importantly, what does the evidence say? Well, we know that Christianity was not fully accepted in Rome until the rule of Constantine in the year 313. So over 200 years of history happened between the fire and that moment, which was written by the victors who were not Christian. So I had to kind of accept that I probably will never be satisfied with the information that we have, which is not much at all. In the case of Priscilla and Aquila, the only evidence we have that they were martyred in this persecution in the year 64 is that their names are included in an early list of the first martyrs of the Church of Rome, because all of these martyrs were celebrated on the feast day of July 8th. So it's like July 8th, we celebrate their feast day. We call them the first martyrs of Rome. A bunch of them, we have no idea who they were, but Priscilla and Aquila are included by name. So probably, I mean, they probably were killed. But that's the only evidence we have. The church tradition that says that they were martyred together at this time may have come from sermons by early church fathers. Unfortunately, we don't have a clear answer for what happened to Priscilla and Aquila. We do, however, have a bit clearer idea about Peter and a much clearer idea about Paul. We have three contemporary sources who mention the fate of Paul, the disciple Timothy, who has some books in the Bible, Pope St. Clement I, and Ignatius, the Patriarch of Antioch. All three of these people say that Paul was arrested following the fire and was executed. None of them go into detail about the trial or execution at all. The Greek historian Eusebius says that Paul was martyred at the same time and place as Peter. Peter, of course, was the number one apostle, although if you ask me, the number one apostle was actually Mary Magdalene, but that I already ranted about that in an earlier episode. Peter was the first pope. He was pope before pope was a thing. He was the rock of the church, and church history tells us that Peter was crucified upside down because he felt that he did not deserve to die the same way that Jesus died. So that's where St. Peter's cross comes from. It's been appropriated as like a pseudo satanic symbol, which is really funny because there's nothing satanic about it.
And mostly, it's also really funny because it's not the satanic cross.
Right.
They have their whole other cross.
Yeah. So to me, it's like, okay, you know nothing about anything when people like try to be edgy and wear like upside down crosses.
Or like, even we used to have a teacher at the high school who, if you ever put like an upside down cross in an art piece, she would have the school take it down because it was horrible. It's just so disrespectful to have an upside down cross on the high school walls. And I'm like, it's not even satanic.
Right. It's literally so far from satanic. That's funny. Yeah. She obviously doesn't know about St. Peter, which is kind of funny for her. So yeah, we're pretty sure we know how Peter died. We don't know how Paul died for sure, although Tertullian and others say that he was beheaded, like John the Baptist. A later legend embellishes the story of him being beheaded, and has Paul's severed head bounce around on the ground after it's chopped off. And says that it bounced three times, and that each time it bounced, a spring of water sprang up from the ground, which is how the church later built at his execution site got the name of St. Paul at the Three Fountains. Make of that what you will, make nothing of that.
I don't know what I make of that.
Understandable.
So many questions.
Yep. An even later legend tells us that St. Paul's remains were buried outside the city in the home of a local Christian woman named Lucina. I like that we know her name, which is why I included it, even though it's not really relevant. In the 4th century, Constantine had a church built there to receive pilgrims visiting St. Paul's tomb, and he called the church the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. It's a lot more elegant in Italian.
It's still very rhymy.
It is. It's kind of bouncy, just like his severed head. Maybe that's where it comes from. In the year 433, part of the church collapsed, and in the renovation process, I think it was an earthquake, but in the renovation process, the floor was elevated to sort of prevent that from happening again, I guess. So this is exactly like a landlord like painting over your smoke detector or bugs or whatever. But they raised the elevation of it, of the floor, by just like building over all the graves, all the tombs.
They're in there for good. They're real secure.
They're sealed up in there.
I would like to imagine that they did it and then they realized what they did.
Oh,
I just watched a video yesterday of a guy who tried to tie a Christmas tree to the top of his truck, mm-hmm. and he went, like, he had rope, but he went through the windows instead of opening the doors, so he couldn't get in the car.
Oh my God.
And it was just somebody recording him from, like, across the way. And in complete shame, this guy crawled into his own trunk and closed it and just sat there.
I would have done the same thing.
It kind of reminds me. I hope it was something like that. They didn't just realize, like, what they were doing.
Leaning on their shovels afterward, and they're like,
oh, shit.
Well, we've done it now. There's no going back. There's no, like, digging it up and starting over again. So the good news is, good or bad, I don't know, hard to tell. In 1823, a fire completely destroyed the basilica. So a new one was built on top of the remains of it. So not only is the tomb underneath the ground, then there's a church on top of it. That church is rubble now. Now we build a new church on top of the rubble.
That, like, really is the landlord painting over everything in white.
Literally.
It's like, oh, we could clear it out, or we could just smush it down. Just make sure it's solid.
Smush it on down. That's what they did. So it's debris, it's marble, everything. So when the Catholic Church celebrated its, they called it the Jubilee year. In the year 2000, they decided to begin excavations in the basilica because it was rumored to have the tomb of St. Paul. They're like, okay, let's see if it's really there. So they decided to begin the excavations and find the tomb, which they did. They did find a tomb. They found a white marble sarcophagus containing bone fragments, incense, and precious purple linens, which I love the detail. Gotta love the concrete detail. Concrete. So researchers carbon dated the bone fragments to the first or second century. So as far as the church is concerned, that is proof enough that these are St. Paul's relics.
I love with church when it comes to proof. They're like, yeah, good enough.
Good enough.
I know there were a lot of dudes back then, but clearly this is our guy.
Clearly he's the one. So really, it could have been any of the martyrs that were killed during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's really no more proof that it's St. Paul, except kind of like local tradition, which I guess is sometimes tradition for a reason. So I don't know what I think.
I love so much whenever this happens in stories, just picturing like the ghost of that person, if it's not who they say it is. It's just like, wow, I'm really special. Lots of people come to see me.
They love me here. It's like some random.
They have my name wrong, but.
But they got the spirit. Mm-hmm. They're a little confused, but they got the spirit. So where does this all leave us? This half evidence, half conjecture, half whatever. I'm not sure where it leaves us. I never claimed
with a pile of bones is where it leaves
us. With some dusty old bones,
some ambiguous bones,
random bones, a lot of stories. I never claimed to be certain about where this was going. I mentioned there would be holes in the story. So that's all I got for you today. Those are the first martyrs of the Church of Rome.
I didn't know that they had anything to do with the fire. So that was news to me.
I did not either.
Those were such separate events in my head.
I never connected it to like the early Christians.
No, never. When you think about like classics, classes and stuff, you don't think about like Christians, you think about like marble statues and sarcophagi and
of course there had to be an overlap, otherwise like they don't exist in vacuums, but that's so difficult to comprehend. And I do think it's cool that this random married couple, just because they were really nice to Paul, got to be in the Bible a bunch. That's very cute for them.
I need to be nicer and have more friends, because then maybe I'll get to be in some kind of holy book someday. I don't know.
I mean, maybe. But how do you tell who to be nice to? You can't.
It's so much effort.
Yeah. Just be civil to everybody until they piss you off. And then you can be mean.
And then I will go full Nero.
Full Nero.
Human torch them.
Human torch. Full human torch their asses. Next time, my mom will be joining us.
I don't know how to act.
Same way you always do.
Yeah, I just, even whenever I go home to see like my grandparents and stuff, I like cut all of the cursing out of my language. Mm. And then every time I curse on accident, I feel like I've murdered a small child. So I'd be like, this, I'm going to feel the same way with your mom.
You don't have to. She's pretty chill.
Well, I'm excited to meet her, but I will be nervous the entire time.
Don't be nervous. It's going to be okay. Yeah, my mom will be on next episode. She'll be talking about one of her favorite things. I might just let her do all the talking because I don't really feel like researching anything. We'll see. That was fun. Rome, all things ancient Rome. Email us, Instagram. I'm going to post some really cool paintings, I think, of the fire. Maybe a picture of the bones if I can find one. And I'll
probably find some depictions of the creatures that I talked about.
Yeah, I want to know what, like, if people have drawn or painted, like, a Strix. Like, I want to know, like, what it looks like. That's cool.
Yeah, they have. They're cool. I'll grab some. I'll throw them up there. We'll get some stuff from Ballard. Whatever he wants to put online.
Yeah, maybe just a selfie.
Yes.
That would be fun. And we will see you next time. Thanks for listening, and thanks be to God.
Blessed be.